welcome back to the ESVS Podcasts. This is Laurence Bertrand, and you are listening to the last and final episode, part four of the Q&A series of the recently published first ever ESVS Clinical Practice Guidelines on the Management of Vascular Trauma. In this series, we are systematically discussing each section, focusing on the most complex and controversial recommendations. Today, for the fourth and final episode of this series, we will specifically talk about sections 7 through 10, including pediatric vascular trauma, gaps in the evidence, and last but not least, patient perspectives. I'm happy to introduce two members of the guideline writing committee with me today, Professor Dr. Carl Wahlgren and Dr. Lazar Davidovich. Dr. Wahlgren is a chair of the guideline writing committee and a vascular surgeon and adjunct professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. We have already had the pleasure of interviewing him in part one of this series. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us again.
And Professor Dr. Davidovich is a vascular surgeon and an ESVS executive committee member. He headed the clinic for vascular and endovascular surgery of the Serbian University Clinical Center in Belgrade and recently served as dean of the faculty of the Medical University of Belgrade. Welcome.
Welcome. Pleasure to meet you.
Let us start with the pediatric vascular trauma. As I understand, this has been your point of focus in the guidelines, Dr. Davidovich. Isn't that right?
Yes, it was a great pleasure and honor for me.
There are six recommendations in the guideline in this area, focusing on pediatric vascular trauma, all with level C evidence, highlighting the lack of it in this field. It must have been very difficult to create this section with limited data. Isn't that right? Why did the committee feel it was important to include this separate section despite this?
I agree with that. The preparation was not easy. Namely, traumatic vascular injuries in children are relatively uncommon and account for only 0.3 to 1.4% of all pediatric civil injuries. The rate of pediatric vascular trauma is higher in war circumstances. So it is not unexpected that there are no prospective randomized trials dedicated to pediatric vascular trauma. Our recommendations mostly had to be based on small retrospective single-center studies, then on consensus opinions of experts, as well as on relatively small number of meta-analyses. Due to this, all recommendations related to pediatric vascular trauma in our guidelines are at the level C. However, we believe that the recommendations will be very useful for all surgeons involved in the management of the pediatric vascular trauma in their contemporary practice.
As discussed in the guidelines, one of the important differences with adult vascular surgery overall, other than caliber, is vasospasm and growth. While these problems are not specifically addressed in the recommendations, they are discussed in a broader sense in the text. In your opinion, in what way can these problems best be mitigated in the context of pediatric vascular trauma?
First of all, small diameter and vasospasm of the injured vessels in children make surgical correction more complex and increases the risk of different early complications. Due to this, in my opinion, only very experienced surgeons should treat pediatric vascular trauma. But at the same time, many surgeons have limited experience of treating these injuries. For instance, at the moment, there is not clearly defined opinion who should treat vascular injuries in children, pediatric or vascular surgeons. Unfortunately, in most countries, including Serbia as well, pediatric surgeons do not have adequate education, adequate surgical training in vascular surgery. On the other hand, vascular surgeons are not educated in pediatric surgery. Due to this, I think that vascular and pediatric surgeons should collaborate during the treatment of pediatric vascular trauma. In addition, children have less developed collaterals as well as smaller total volume of blood with a purer tolerance on hemorrhagic shock. Because of that, pediatric vascular trauma requires more aggressive and earlier treatment in comparison to adults. And finally, due to the growth of repaired artery that was previously injured, checkups are needed more frequently after the treatment of adult patients.
More frequently and perhaps also over a longer period of time.
Yes, absolutely. Probably one time per year. I had personal experience to treat injured children 15 years ago. Some of them were under my control, but some of them not. And due to this, I had opportunity to meet different long-term complications in patients that were not being under control. For instance, I had the opportunity to meet patients with developed aneurysms of the saphenous vein graft that were used for repair of injured artery, which required a very complex procedure 10 or 15 years later. Due to this, permanent control is very important.
Okay, Professor Wahlgren, do you have anything to add for this question focusing on how to mitigate vasospasm and growth?
It's a classical challenges, pediatric vascular trauma and vasospasm is tricky, sometimes also for when you do diagnostics, the vasospasm, but also during surgery. And of course, you can try to mitigate that with different drugs like papaverine or nitro, for example, good intravascular volume. There is a lot of discussions and also in the guidelines if on some technical aspects regarding growth. And that is a challenge in pediatric vascular trauma. There's not much evidence out there, but there is some suggestion about interrupted sutures. For example, when you suture the posterior wall in the anastomosis, you can do interrupted sutures. Sometimes you can do beveled anastomosis just to accommodate a little bit better. But otherwise, sometimes actually you have to redo children later on because of growth. Some actually, when you use synthetic grafts, sometimes Dacron grafts can stretch the baby a little bit more, or some surgeons prefer to have a little bit of a slack when they put in the graft. But otherwise, you have to follow them, of course, and sometimes you have to do redos.
So picking up on your comment about growth, I would like to ask about recommendation 101, class 2A, level C. This one states that endovascular stent repair should be considered as the first-line operative treatment for children with blunt thoracic aortic injury, that is, for ESVS grade 2 or 3, and an appropriate anatomy. However, you also mentioned that an initial non-operative approach in grade 2 lesions also seems reasonable in children. How are we to interpret this, and what can help in decision-making in such a scenario? Also, how would an endovascular thoracic stent best be sized in a growing child? And are there really stents available to cater to this recommendation?
So this is a challenge, of course. There's not much data in the very young patient with blunt thoracic aortic injuries. Small injuries, like the grade 1 injuries, can probably be treated very well conservatively. The grade 2 injuries with small pseudoaneurysm can probably also be treated in a conservative way. And also alluding to the adult population, there is also data supporting more delayed treatment, even for children. And especially if you have a small pseudoaneurysm, you don't have to run to the OR in the middle of the night to treat that. You can wait. And there is a challenge with the sizing, with the stent grafts. For kids, you can see this more like an acute solution as a bridge, maybe, to treat something that is serious. If for example, if you have a grade 3 injury with ongoing bleeding, you can see it more like a bridge and to use a cover stent. And there is a challenge with sizing because of small vessels, sometimes steep angles with up in the arch. You have to use the best available graft that you have on your shelf. Sometimes cover stents using for aortic coarctation can be used for these types of injuries. But I think you should look at it as a bridge to treat something that is threatening life. And maybe when you have a more stable situation during longer follow-up, this can be converted to open surgery, of course, if needed.
Do you mean can be or should be converted in the long term?
I think it depends. Some of these kids could develop problems that we don't really know so much about at the moment. And of course, you need to talk to parent and the child that you need to have long-term surveillance for this. If there is a problem with growth, you need to, of course, discuss conversion. You don't need to rush into that. We have had very few cases in these very young patients, but there are data out there that they have been treated with stent graft as a bridge and then later converted to open surgery.
Thank you. Professor Davidovich, do you have anything to add on this question?
I'm not endovascular expert, but I will have one short comment. First of all, I think that the main reason for non-operative approach in pediatric patients with grade 2 of aortic blood trauma is associated injuries, associated polytrauma. The main problem that experience for the treatment of pediatric aortic blood trauma is very, very small, insignificant. Not known authors have not more than few cases. So finally, I think that we cannot answer precisely on that question at the moment.
And also this is a class 2 recommendation and not as strong as in the adult population. Mm-hmm. That's why we don't have the data.
Okay, moving on. Recommendation 100, class 1 level C states, early antithrombotic therapy is recommended for children with blunt low-grade carotid artery injury, that is grade 1 or 2 ESVS. What is meant by early exactly, and what is your drug of choice for children? And how long would you personally prescribe this?
A very important and difficult question at the same time. Surgical repair should be also avoided in majority cases of blunt peripheral arterial trauma in children. However, there are not many articles regarding antithrombotic therapy in children. I found some of them during my preparation for this conversation. These articles mostly come from pediatric cardiology. In my opinion, antithrombotic therapy after peripheral arterial and carotid blunt trauma in children is similar that used after placement of different intracardiac stents or shunts in children. And according to some studies, dose of aspirin required for optimal inhibition of platelet aggregation in pediatric population is not known, although empiric low dose of 1 to 5 milligram per kilogram per day have been proposed. Prospective multicenter randomized placebo-controlled trial evaluating pharmacodynamics of clopidogrel in children by platelet aggregometry studies showed that clopidogrel at dose of 0.20 milligram per kilogram per day in children, platelet inhibition level similar to that in adults taking 75 milligrams per day. At the same time, these authors recommend antithrombotic therapy 6 months after intracardiac procedure. Probably we should recommend the same period after peripheral and carotid blunt trauma in children. It is my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And overall, the data is, of course, lacking to give really good recommendations in the guidelines for this because the literature is very sparse. And some of the recent meta-analysis, they are actually excluding patients below 18. So it's only, but overall with risk profiles and the risk for bleeding versus ischemia, in general, we recommend that antiplatelet regime seems to be more appropriate than more antithrombotic therapy with low molecular weight heparin. But data is lacking. We just have to say that. It's also difficult to say how long it should be because we really don't know. You also need to follow up these patients with surveillance as well, usually not CT. You can use like MRA or duplex ultrasound to follow these patients. And there are literature, as Professor Davidovich suggested, that you can have this for 6 months. Some say 3 months. It depends, of course, when it's healed, it's healed. I think you should maybe stop it. But we don't really know here. This is one of the areas where we don't really have good data in the children.
So despite not having good data, it seems that there is a consensus between you that 6 months is an adequate time to give an antithrombotic therapy. And that brings me actually to the first part of the question. What do we mean by early? If a child has a blunt injury to a carotid, surely there is also a risk of a concomitant injury or concomitant brain injury. Then I imagine that some physicians would have some hesitation to start an antithrombotic therapy right away on the same day. Is this what is meant by early? Are we expected to start them
early
right
is
away?
Meant as soon there is no risk for bleeding, you should start it. So as early as possible. And that, of course, need to be individualized. Bleeding, of course, first priority, ischemia, second priority. But this needs to be started early because we have had patients with carotid dissection that where the treatment has been starting too late because of bleeding concerns, sometimes also that it has been delayed, and that's not good. It should be started early.
Okay, thank you for specifying. Last, on pediatric surgery, I was somewhat surprised that recommendation 99, class 1 level C, recommended computer tomography angiography as the first line investigation to identify or rule out vascular injury in hemodynamically stable pediatric trauma patients. Why not take ultrasound first and CTA second if necessary? Also, is there perhaps not a place for emergency MRI in this space?
Okay, multi-dissector CT angiography quickly and accurately answers all important diagnostic questions regarding vascular trauma, including pediatric as well. First of all, it shows there is or there isn't vascular injury, then its location, its extent, as well as its complexity. The multi-detector CT angiography finding may also help to indicate surgical approach as well as type of vascular repair. On the other hand, ultrasound cannot answer all these questions. Due to this, in my opinion, ultrasound is recommended for post-procedural control as well as for the follow-up. Regarding MRI, I will have only one very short comment. MRI angiography is not available for emergencies in many hospitals, including mine as well. Then during MRI, children should be under general anesthesia. It is also one problem. And finally, in many hospitals, including mine, the radiologists are not educated to interpret MRI finding after vascular trauma.
I agree. I would say that CTA has established as the first imaging modality because it's available 24/7 in most hospitals all around the world, more or less. It has also been shown to have a very good sensitivity and specificity for vascular injuries in the pediatric population, not only in the adult population. So, and that's also both for penetrating and blunt trauma. So in the initial diagnostic phase, I think CTA is now more or less established. But then, of course, for surveillance afterwards, duplex ultrasound could be a good option. For example, thoracic aortic injuries, MRA could be a possibility if you have that modality in your hospital. So I completely agree.
Before moving on to gaps in the evidence, are there any other recommendations in the pediatric vascular trauma section that you would like to bring our attention to?
We have had a nice discussion about some of the highlights from the guidelines. Yes, it's difficult with the pediatric because it's not so much data out there, especially in abdominal vascular injury. But there are some studies from an epidemiology perspective, but I think extremity vascular trauma is the most common form of vascular trauma in the pediatric population, especially upper extremity vascular injuries, and especially supracondylar humerus fractures with brachial artery injuries. And there is a recommendation about that, a 2A class recommendation about non-operative management in children with a pink and warm but pulseless hand post supracondylar humerus fracture reduction. And I think that could be important to at least highlight a little bit.
I personally have some recommendation as well. First of all, there are significant relative contraindication to using prosthetic grafts because of long-term patency concerns. Saphenous vein is material of choice, but vein graft dilatation is expected over time. Due to this, some authors recommend reinforcement of the vein graft with synthetic mesh. I personally do not have such experience, but a few minutes ago I explained that I had patients with saphenous vein graft aneurysms 10 and 15 years after the treatment. Then neointimal hyperplasia is potentially more frequent in children than in adults because of longer follow-up. Due to this, children require more frequent control examination than adults. We already spoke about it.
Thank you for those insights. That brings us nicely into the section about gaps in the evidence, which has already shown to be an issue in the pediatric vascular trauma section. The guidelines have created a separate section, section 9, to highlight this issue and even listed the most relevant issues in a table, table 12. Why did you feel this was important to do?
We just wanted to give a little bit of an overview of some of the evidence gaps or conflicting evidence, and also to give some research priorities for the future.
No guidelines can anticipate all clinical situations, especially if most of recommendations are of the level C. In my opinion, with table 12, we wanted to warn surgeons in which situation our guidelines will not be enough.
Indeed, out of the 105 recommendations issued, the vast majority, 90 to be precise, are classed as level C. That means data derived from consensus opinion of experts, from low quality studies, that is small retrospective studies or case series, or meta-analyses of such studies, while only 11 are level B, data derived from a single randomized trial, high-quality non-randomized studies, or meta-analyses of such studies, and a mere 4 are level A, that is based on data derived from multiple randomized trials or meta-analysis of randomized trials. With that in mind, this might be the biggest consensus paper ever contrived. It must have been very difficult. Congratulations. What, in your opinion, are the biggest obstacles facing research in vascular trauma?
Thank you, Laurence, for the nice words, of course. And we are very happy also that the society prioritized this vascular trauma work. Looking back also, funding, for example, for vascular trauma research has been low, considering actually the huge global burden that trauma and injury provides. There are no patient organizations, there are not much funding out there and not so much support. And some factors regarding challenges in research is, of course, the acute way these patients arrive. They are coming in late at night, they're coming in during weekends. It's difficult to do research. Some of these patients are coming from low socioeconomic groups. It's difficult with follow-up. They are not coming back for surveillance or follow-up. So all these together are challenges that research in trauma in general, but also vascular trauma is facing.
Maybe I could say that it is impossible and unethical to ask a life-threatening patient to participate in any of studies that is especially delicate after pediatric vascular trauma. Therefore, only retrospective analysis can be used regardless of their well-known disadvantages.
Yeah, that leads me to the one of my questions, which is talking about the struggle around patient consent for participation in trauma vascular studies. Surely the trauma setting is not the place for asking for patient consent beforehand. On the other hand, if we only collect consent retrospectively, there's surely a bias for survivors, because the vascular trauma section is clearly a area of vascular surgery where their mortality is high. What are your thoughts on the matter?
All trauma research, of course, should follow the ethical regulations and should, of course, have undergone appropriate ethic committee discussions and approvals. And there are some differences, of course, in countries. And just looking, for example, in one of the big randomized controlled trials we refer to the CRASH II trials, which was a randomized controlled trial of antifibrinolytics in hemorrhage. If I remember right, the informed consent was obtained from patients if physical and mental capacity allowed. If the patient could not give consent, a proxy consent was obtained from a relative or a representative. Sometimes that could be also a legally authorized representative. If a proxy was unavailable and if that was permitted by local regulation, consent was deferred or waived. And when consent was deferred or given by a proxy, the patient was informed about the trial as soon as possible and consent was obtained for the use of data collection if needed, etc. So that was one way of trying to work with informed consent and in an ethical way. But it's, of course, challenging in coming in the acute setting what is reasonable to do. And I know there's been some countries has actually been struggling with this, and they have not been able to take part in some of the randomized controlled trials.
With the exception of wartime in Ukraine, luckily there are not many vascular trauma cases in the European setting at the moment. Do you think there is a place for an international registry to help share the little data that is available?
I think it would, especially if with a lot of disease that is maybe in low frequency, I think it could be interesting to have a registry internationally. And we actually was looking for the guidelines and checking with different countries what kind of vascular trauma registration they had within the vascular registries. And it varied a lot from different countries. Some countries actually have registry that includes some of the vascular trauma specifics, but it would, of course, be interesting, like the VascuNet or something like that, to have a more a general, broad international registry to collect some of this data.
At the end of the 20th century, former Yugoslavia, as you know, experienced civil war, while Serbia in 1999 experienced NATO bombing. Thanks to these really unpleasant facts, my generation of vascular surgeons in Serbia, including myself as well, had an opportunity to treat significant number of war vascular injuries. It was a significant experience. Many of our articles and new internal recommendations, my clinic internal recommendation, have been results from that experience. Due to this, international registry with war vascular injuries from Ukraine war would be also very, very useful. However, in my opinion, it should include data from both sides, from the Ukraine and from Russia.
The studies that are available from the military setting represent a specific set of lesions and also a specific set of patients. Do you think it is still valid to use such data to treat the general civilian population with vascular trauma in the civilian setting?
According to the common opinion, the management of vascular injuries is fundamentally different compared to war and civil circumstances. However, in nowadays, it is not necessarily so. For instance, results of our study from 2005 with 273 civil and 140 peripheral war vascular injuries didn't show significant difference between them regarding the early outcome. Due to this, registers of vascular injuries, in my opinion, are very useful for the treatment of civil vascular trauma as well.
Now, your text mentions the possibility of using artificial intelligence, AI, for helping us to fill many of the knowledge gaps. Could you elaborate on this? How may this be of use to us?
There are some studies that have used machine learning for prediction models for some limb salvage. We have discussed in the guidelines that some of these scoring system for limb salvage is not really useful. And with machine learning models, maybe some of these prediction models for outcome could be valuable. Risk of bleeding or risk for thrombotic problems could also maybe be something with machine learning for and use of prediction models. So this is, of course, an evolving field in medicine in general.
Thank you for sharing. One last question on this. If you can choose one, what in your opinion of all these gaps is the most urgent missing knowledge we need to fill immediately?
Some of the gaps that maybe can do some improvements is, of course, hemostatic resuscitation. If we can have better chances to control bleeding or coagulopathy, and then technical development, of course, endovascular graft materials. Could we use something different than veins? For example, bovine or other acellular matrix grafts for arterial reconstructions. We don't need to harvest a graft. Could that be something? And also the problem with stent grafts and having stent grafts for the rest of your life in your aorta. Could we have something that is absorbable or disappear eventually when the injury has healed? Could that be something? So there is a need for better technical developments, both for open and endovascular procedures in the vascular trauma setting.
Before ending this last episode in the four-part series of the new ESVS Vascular Trauma Guidelines, I would like to ask about Section 10. This section addresses the patients directly and uses plain language to explain several aspects of vascular trauma medicine. It has not always been typical of guidelines to include such a section, has it? Why did the committee feel it was important now?
There is no strong patient organizations within this field. And even if this is a very short chapter, we felt it was reasonable to include that.
Successful management of vascular trauma, which manifests itself with bleeding, begins with primary bleeding control. But if it is not performed adequately, primary bleeding control can additionally damage already injured vessels. At the same time, very often primary bleeding control from injured vessels has to be done by those who are not medically educated. Due to this, the Section 10 could be also important.
Thank you for that additional information. This interesting discussion wraps up the last Q&A on the new ESVS Vascular Trauma Guideline. Thank you both for joining us today and sharing your time and expertise with us. It has been a pleasure.
Participation in the preparing, in the writing of these guidelines was really great honor and privilege for me. At the same time, it was a great challenge. Professor Jean-Baptiste Ricot explained it in the best possible way. Writing of guidelines is not a sprint, it is a marathon.
A lot of thanks to you in this podcast committee that we have a chance to spread a little bit of the content from the guidelines. So thank you a lot and very nice discussions. So looking forward to hear more about this.
And now to the whole writing committee, thank you. And thank you for your tremendous work, which will surely help all vascular surgeons and their patients. Thank you to our listeners as well. A lot of new podcasts are coming up this year. Make sure to follow our socials and be in the loop of the next releases soon. To you all, have a great day and goodbye.